Welcome to Kadampa Podcasts. These podcasts offer practical solutions to daily challenges and help guide us to a happier and more peaceful state of mind. In each episode, you will find an extract from a teaching given by one of various Kadampa Buddhist teachers worldwide. All these teachings are inspired by the profound wisdom of Venerable Geshe Kalsang Gyatso Rinpoche, a Buddhist master for our time. We hope you will enjoy listening.
When your mind is calm, there's good stuff in there that can start to manifest naturally when you're calm. When you're stressed out and annoyed and distracted, it's tough for the goodness within you to naturally manifest. But when your mind is calm and peaceful and you relax through something like breathing meditation, what you'll notice is you'll feel a little bit happier to see people. People won't be as annoying. You'll feel a little bit more warm towards them. The goodness in you will naturally start to arise. So taking and giving in particular is a different kind of breathing meditation because it deliberately sort of cultivates these qualities. And I was thinking about, you know, it's almost like you can give yourself a job, like an inner job of transforming your mind through these methods. And I was reading something recently about how a lot of people in the world are kind of, let's just say in our country, just think about like my nephews and people I know. A lot of times it's younger people. It doesn't have to be younger people. They're just confused. And there's a lot of apathy and resignation and maybe even hopelessness about the world and their life. And it's kind of aimless and directionless. And obviously this is a big stereotype and that's not the case for lots of people. But for a lot of people it is. And it reminds me of something that my teacher Geshe-la once said about jobs and like what's our real job in life. And so you can kind of, if you want, bifurcate jobs into outer jobs and inner jobs. So you have an outer job, whatever, maybe like if you're working in a normal job out there, and your outer job might be something you don't get paid for, like raising kids or something, but you have a job that you do, something that you spend time doing every day. I used to be a school teacher. My brother sells, I don't know what he sells. My brother sells electronic components, parts. My sister's a paralegal. My dad was an accountant. My mom raised three kids and did some other things, other jobs. But what Geshe-la once said was your real job is to train your mind. That's like your main job. That's your main job, is to train your mind. And it's a really helpful framework, because you can chase the right outer job your whole life and never find it. And it seems like that's what's happening to a lot of people. They're trying to figure out sort of what to do. And it's so complicated now what to do. It used to be you'd be like a farmer. What else? You'd fix shoes. Cobblesmith? Am I making that up? Cobblesmith? Cobbler? Like peach cobbler? Anyway, it shows how complicated it's gotten. I can't even remember the simple jobs that used to be the main jobs, but there was like eight. You had like eight options. Now it's like, now most people go through eight different jobs by the time they're 30, at least. And the point I'm trying to make is, if you're seeking fulfillment in the job, maybe you'll find that. Maybe you'll find something that you can do every day that you love and you find it meaningful and beneficial, and that's great. But a lot of people don't. And then they feel very discouraged and lost. And regardless of what the outer job might be, what Buddha and Geshe-la, his representative, is saying is, if you take as your main job internal development, that'll be the best job, because then you'll take that with you to any job, whatever job you have, whether it's something you don't really like very much. In some ways, that could be even better. You can use that to train your mind. You know, the 84 Mahasiddhas, these are 84 kind of famous meditators in the lineage of what's called the Mahamudra. They generally had jobs that were quite simple, you know, very simple kind of jobs that were repetitive. And they liked those jobs because while they did those jobs, they could be training their mind. They could be practicing Dharma. They could be meditating on the nature of impermanence, the nature of emptiness, and so on and so forth. They could basically use their mind in a very productive and meaningful way whilst they were doing their menial tasks to further their internal development. And if you frame it like that, then it's a win-win, because then if you have a difficult job, if your main job is training the mind, the difficult job will help you do that. If you don't like your job, you don't like your boss, so that's an opportunity to practice patience and compassion and so on and so forth. If you like your job and you enjoy it, well, that's great too. So it's a win-win if you set it up that your main job is the internal job of training your mind. If the main job is to try to fix everything out there to get it just perfectly, like finding the right job, and that's what you're committed to, having to find the right whatever out there, that can be very frustrating. So I'm just mentioning this because one tool that can be kind of a weapon in your arsenal of mind training is taking and giving. And I introduced it last week. I'll just briefly introduce it again now, and then we'll do a nice long taking and giving meditation this morning. So I'm sharing from this book, The New Eight Steps to Happiness, and I'll read a bit of what Geshe-la says about this meditation. So on page 164, Geshe-la is talking about the practice of taking. The way it's taught, it says taking is taught, taking on your own future suffering is taught first, then taking on other suffering is taught, then giving is taught, then taking and giving is taught, and then taking and giving mounted on the breath is taught. We just cut right to the chase and went right to the last one. But if you have time, you may want to do it in order. So here, it's talking about taking. When we start our practice of taking and giving, we do not need to think too much about how it is possible to relieve others' suffering through the power of mind alone. Okay, so we don't have to think too much. Is this doing anything? If I'm practicing taking on my sister, my mother, my friends, is this doing anything? Geshe-la is recommending. You don't have to worry too much about that in the beginning. Instead, we should simply practice taking and giving with a good motivation, understanding it to be a supreme method for increasing our merit and concentration. So taking and giving is a supreme method for increasing your merit. Merit is the energy in your mind that makes you happy and empowers your internal development. You know, merit is like a force in the mind that ripens as happy feelings and also helps you to change in the direction you want to change. So even if you meet teachings like Buddha gives and you learn how to train your mind, sometimes you don't have enough power in your mind to do what you know you're meant to do. And that happens to people who've been around for many years. They know the Dharma intellectually. They know what they're meant to think, but it's hard to do it sometimes. And one reason for that is we don't have enough merit in the mind to help us. It's like fuel for our practice. So merit and concentration are two of the main benefits of taking and giving, and they're related. This practice also purifies our non-virtues and delusions, especially our self-cherishing, you know, the part of our mind that thinks I'm the most important one in the world, and makes our love and compassion very strong. Through gradual training, our meditation on taking and giving will become so powerful that we will develop the ability to directly take on the suffering of others and give them happiness. Then we get some stories. They're wild stories that in a modern context, some people will be skeptical of these stories, but they're true. I believe they're true. I'm going to share them. I think, and I think you'll like them. You may not like them. Doesn't really matter, actually, but it's just good to hear the stories because it's good to crack open your paradigm of reality, because we live in a very limited, myopic, boring, ordinary, material version of reality in terms of a paradigm. And these stories are a very different paradigm for reality, which is basically that your reality depends upon the mind. There are many examples of accomplished yogis or yoginis. These are like fabulous meditators, using their concentration to take on the suffering of other beings with whom they have a karmic connection. There is a story of an Indian Buddhist master called Maitri Yogi who took on the pain of a dog that was being beaten so that the wounds appeared on his body instead of the dog's. The great Tibetan yogi Milarepa had completely mastered the meditation on taking and giving. On one occasion, he took on the suffering of a sick man. But the man refused to believe that it was due to Milarepa that he was free from pain. So Milarepa was kind of like a real character is the right word, but he was a very powerful being, and he didn't care what anybody thought of him, and he just went out to the caves and meditated on his own and was called an Iron Man. He was just a very strong person. And so Milarepa mastered taking and giving. He practices taking and giving on this man and takes away his sickness through the power of his concentration. And the man didn't believe it. So Milarepa, to prove it, returned the pain to him. And when the pain became too much, Milarepa then transferred the pain to a door which began to shake. So, anyway, it's just so cool. Imagine being able to do that. You love someone, you have a karmic connection with them, you practice taking and giving on them, they feel better. And they're like, I don't feel better because you practice taking and giving on me. That has nothing to do with it. I'm like an independent unit. Your mind and energy has nothing to do with my mind and energy. I'm just over here. You're over there. Ne'er the two shall meet. And you have a very different paradigm. You know mind and energy and everything's all connected. And you get it. And you have concentration. You practice taking and giving. Your mind, your energy affects their mind and energy. They don't believe it. And you're like, fine. Take it back. And they're like, ah. And then you're like, okay, let's transfer that energy through mental power to the door. And the door starts to shake. Like, I believe this is true. I believe this can happen. I didn't initially, but after studying Dharma and the mind and all this stuff for a while, now I totally believe this kind of thing. And then Geshe-la continues by saying, faithful Buddhist practitioners believe that when their spiritual guide is ill, in reality, he or she is taking on the suffering of others. Many Christians also believe that by allowing himself to be crucified, Jesus was taking on the sufferings of human beings. It is quite possible that Jesus was practicing taking while he was on the cross. And then what Geshe-la does is he talks about, well, he frames something. If Buddhas and high bodhisattvas have the power to directly take on the suffering of others and bestow happiness upon them, we may wonder why living beings are still suffering. Because Buddhas have this power, they are continuously bestowing blessings on all living beings. So like they're pumping out good energy to everybody all the time with their mind. As a direct result of receiving these blessings, each and every living being, including animals and hell beings, occasionally experience peace of mind. And at these times, they are happy and free from manifest suffering. However, the only way living beings can achieve permanent liberation from suffering is if they actually put Buddha's teachings into practice. Just as a doctor cannot cure a disease unless the sick person actually takes the medicine that the doctor has prescribed, so Buddhas cannot cure our inner disease of delusions unless we actually take the medicine of Dharma. So in other words, in Buddhism, we understand that enlightened beings are omniscient. Their minds are everywhere with everyone all the time forever. Their minds are all loving, unconditionally loving, but they're not omnipotent. Buddhas can't just, they're not all powerful, and they can't just take away your pain forever. Because if they could, they would have, of course. It's a teamwork. The Buddhas can help you and temporarily, like Milarepa did, alleviate your pain. But in the long run, you have to do the work, and I have to do the work, and the Buddhas will help us do that forever. But they can't just do it for us. And I quite like that, because the other way doesn't make an all-loving, omniscient, all-powerful being that's just like, too bad. Maybe they wouldn't say that. I'm sure there's a lot more rich theological interpretation of this other view, but I like the view that Buddhas are omniscient, all loving, but not all powerful, that we have something to do from our side to end our suffering. and the Buddhas will always help. And it concludes with a quote. In the sutras, it says, Buddhas cannot remove sentient beings suffering with their hands, wash the evil from their minds with water, nor give them their realizations like a present, but they can lead them to liberation by revealing ultimate truth. Even when the sun is shining, if our house is shuttered, only a little light can enter, and our house will remain cold and dark. But if we open the shutters, the warm rays of the sun will come pouring in. Similarly, even though the sun of Buddha's blessings is always shining, if our mind is shuttered by our lack of faith, few blessings can enter and our mind will remain cold and dark. But by developing strong faith, our mind will open and the full sun of Buddha's blessings will come pouring in. Faith is the life force of spiritual practice. We need to have unshakable faith in Buddha's teachings, or we will never find the energy to put these teachings into practice. So unshakable faith is, that's a long-term goal, but everybody here has some faith in Buddha's teachings, unless you were dragged here. So you have some faith in the teachings. You think, all right, this must be useful, this must be beneficial. And over time, as you practice the teachings, your confidence in the teachings grows, and you realize, oh, they really work. And we've talked about, and half-jokingly making a T-shirt that says, wow, Dharma works. Because it's interesting, when you actually practice Dharma, it really works. And sometimes it's hard to do it, but when you do, it does. Okay, so that's from earlier on in the chapter. And then we'll take about 7 or 8 more minutes, and then we'll do the main meditation. I did want to read a little bit more from the end of the chapter on taking and giving mounted on the breath. Once we are proficient at this meditation on mounting, taking, and giving upon the breath, it is very powerful because there is a close relationship between the breath and the mind. The breath is related to the inner energy winds that flow through the channels of our body and that act as the vehicles or mounts for different types of awareness. So there's energy winds that flow through your body, and those energy winds, Buddha is saying, are mounts for your thoughts. It's like your thoughts are connected to the energy winds, basically. By harnessing our breath for virtuous purposes, we purify our inner energy winds. And when pure winds are flowing through our channels, pure minds arise naturally. So it's a little bit of a tantric presentation of the subtle body. Many people practice breathing meditation, but the most widely practiced type consists simply of concentrating on the sensation of the breath, entering and leaving the nostrils, like we did to start the class. This serves to calm the mind temporarily and reduces distracting thoughts. But it does not have the power to effect a deep and lasting transformation of our mind. Combining breathing meditation with the practice of taking and giving, however, has the power to transform our mind from its present miserable and self-centered state into the blissful and altruistic mind of a bodhisattva. I always find that sentence funny. It's like the confidence of the author. He's just saying, look, I know you're miserable and self-centered, but it doesn't have to be that way. You can keep doing this, and you can be a total superstar human. You could be a bodhisattva. And it's actually very encouraging. It improves our concentration, makes our love and compassion very strong, and accumulates vast merit. In this way, the simple act of breathing is transformed into a powerful spiritual practice. At first, we do this practice only in meditation, but with familiarity, we can do it at any time. Through deep familiarity with this practice, our mind will eventually transform into the compassion of a Buddha.
If you feel inspired by this podcast, then dive deeper into timeless wisdom of modern Kadampa Buddhism by following the link in the episode description. We look forward to reconnecting with you in the next episode of Kadampa Podcasts.